Images on the screen behind me. Motion to approve the agenda. So moved. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carries. Okay. Item number two is the approval of the minutes of November 9th. Second? Okay. All in favor? Opposed? And abstentions? None. Okay, that motion carries. Item number three, let's start out with item number three, announcements. Anyone who has an announcement, please come to the mic.
Hi, I'm Ron Rothenberg, Math Department. I have an announcement. This is about this poster in the lobby on the first floor of this building. And on the poster, there's a statement, 80 years of building futures, Queens College alumni. And then there appears pictures of 16 notable people who attended Queens College. But of the 16, I have found at least four are not alumni. They're not alumni. According to the standard definition of alumni that I'm used to is an alumnus or alumnus is a person who has completed his studies, especially at a college or university. Another one, I have a handout up front, two-page handout. Another one, American Heritage Dictionary alumnus, a graduate of a school, college, or university. Vocabulary.com, an alumnus is a graduate of a school. An alumnus has received a diploma or degree from a school. So of the 16 people that we claim are alumni, by the way, there is another definition of alumnus which is floating around, which says an alumnus is anyone who attended a college or a school, in this case, Queens College. The question is, do we want to accept that definition or the definition that I mentioned previously? If we accept this looser definition, that would mean that anyone who dropped out or flunked out of Queens College would be classified as an alumnus. Do we want that definition? All right, that's the thing I wanted to bring up. And I believe that when we have this poster in the front lobby of Queens College, we are representing the greatness of this school. So in such a poster, we should not have any misinformation. Everything should be crystal clear. Now, I point out in my two-page article that there are many, many notable people who graduated Queens College and who actually are alumni. They're alumni because, by my definition, the usual definition, they graduated Queens College. So you have people like Joy Behar, Annette Insdorf. It's an announcement, Al. I'm announcing something. It's announcing. Look up announcing in the dictionary, okay? And others, as you can read in my two-page handout, several famous mathematicians, a well-known chemical researcher who died recently, Robert Bittman, and others. So I think that if we have this poster in the main lobby of Queens College, representing the Queens College, it should be honest. And everything on that poster should be true to life. And we should not have anything that's questionable. In particular, one of the people, Carole King, great singer, I love her, saw her play twice. However, she probably did not even finish one semester at Queens College.
Any other announcements? Okay, if there are no other announcements.
I have a memorial notice for Eileen O'Neill, who was a member of the philosophy department here at Queen's College and then on the doctoral faculty at the Graduate Center from 1983 to 1997. She was born in 1953, grew up on the Upper West Side, Irish parents, loyal parishioners at the Church of Notre Dame on Morningside Avenue up there. She got her BA from Barnard in 1975 and her PhD from Princeton in 1983, and that was the year that she began here. In 1997, she moved, as I said, to UMass Amherst. Her principal importance is as a scholar who brought to light the extraordinary contributions of women in early modern philosophy. These extremely learned and important women who were members of philosophical salons and correspondents of some of the greatest thinkers of the time, who were often very famous in their own time, but whose history was subsequently neglected. And if you want to see a very good example of Eileen O'Neill's work, there's a very famous paper of hers which is called Disappearing Ink, which is precisely about how these women were written out of the history of modern philosophy. She produced a scholarly edition of Margaret Cavendish, one of the important early modern women thinkers, and also has inspired a whole generation of historians of early modern philosophy to uncover works by neglected women writers like Madame du Châtelet, and Anne Conway, and Margaret Cavendish. She had been ill for a number of years, cycling through treatment and recovery and relapse, and she died over the weekend. And I would ask for a moment of silence from the body.
Everyone, please rise for a moment of silence. Thank you very much. Can we continue with the memorials?
Well, with sadness, I report that our colleague, Mark Mixick, who also served as academic senate for quite a few years, I think, and Mark Mixick passed away in November after a long illness. And Mark began his tenure in the physics department in the 60s and was active in the civil rights movements on campus. He was perhaps best known on campus as the director of the Science Teacher Careers Program, where he was a devoted mentor to many future science teachers. And he also created a middle school science fair, the Investigative Science Symposium, that attracted close to 200 students annually for several years. Mark was an avid tennis player and frequently played with Jim Myskins. He was known across campus as an exceptional collegial and dedicated faculty member. And the department will distribute a campus-wide message in the near future. Maybe we could have a moment of silence for Mark.
Everyone, please stand. Thank you very much. Any further announcements or administrative reports?
I have a moment of silence announcement also for a math professor who died recently, Professor William Emerson. He came here in the 1970s. He was a outstanding scholar as a youth, and in college, he finished in the top five of this very prestigious and difficult exam, the Putnam exam, top five in the country twice. At any rate, he was a great guy, and I miss him sorely, and I hope we could have a moment of silence for William Emerson. Everyone, please stand. Thank you very much. Okay, if there are no further announcements, administrative reports, let's go to our guest speaker today is the chapter chair from the Professional Staff Congress for Queens College. There is David standing over there. And we thought instead of waiting 7 years, we've only been waiting 7 days since our contract expired, so we got to jump on everything. Let me introduce David Gerwin.
Thank you, Manny. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. So I want to just give a quick update on the new contract demands and also let you know about something called the Janus case, which is a big challenge that's facing not just our union, but unions across the country and really workers everywhere. Just to let you know, the union has formally requested since mid-November to Bill Thompson, the chair of the CUNY Board of Trustees, that the university begin bargaining, and has sent a really detailed list of bargaining demands that you can see online at the PSC CUNY website. Nobody needs to, there's no password or sign in. You can just look under the contract section. You can see these requests. Some of the highlights are a 5% across the board salary increase for each year of the contract to come, compounded. The sooner they negotiate a contract, the less we have to talk about back pay. And that's in all titles, including EOC titles and continuing education. I think one that people have heard a lot about is that adjuncts, the lowest payment for the lowest ranking adjunct should be $7,000 per course. And when I was at a rally on Monday evening, some Baruch students were standing around looking at the signs and saying, oh, $7,000 a month. Yeah, that's what an adjunct should be paid. I tried to explain to them that faculty are not all making $7,000 a month, and HEOs are not making all $7,000 a month, and that in fact, $7,000 per course would be getting people not off food stamps in New York necessarily if they're only teaching two courses a semester, but with healthcare and that pay, it would go a large way towards helping people who get paid under $3,500, of course, now. There's talk about step movement, making the five-year steps three-year steps, a lot of efforts to support department chairs in different ways as the workload has increased. And some other pieces in it, including adjustments to the way that the long-serving adjuncts, the three-year appointments work, that you should qualify with 10 semesters in any 14-semester period, not 10 consecutive, that kind of thing. Anyway, you can see those demands. And if anyone has questions or suggestions, I'm happy to take a question or two or a note or two in a moment, because there's a delegate assembly this evening. The other thing, I want to stress that there's mobilizing about this. There was a rally of 400 to 500 people outside the Board of Trustees meeting, and this was not a lot of District 37 members on the inside and a few CUNY faculty on the outside. This was really CUNY students and faculty and staff, 400 to 500 strong, screaming and yelling outside of a Board of Trustees meeting, and it felt good. And I think that's the kind of thing that will help us get a contract. The other thing that I want you to know is the big threat. So it's already a difficult environment where the tax bill that may get reconciled and passed in Washington has bad implications for New York. It's already a tough environment where we have divided government in New York, and the state Senate is run by the Republicans, and Cuomo likes it that way and does not want any reconciliation between the Democrats in the Senate and the independent Democrats before the budget season is concluded. So that's all difficult. But what I want you to know is that the Supreme Court has a case scheduled that already has been heard last year in a different name. It was Friedrichs last year, it's Janus this year. It makes a very simple argument. It says that under the First Amendment, Glenda, you can correct me if I get any of this wrong. I'm a historian, not an attorney. Under the First Amendment, your right to free speech and freedom of association is protected. Joining a union should be a purely voluntary act, is their argument, for all public employees. And the simple reason is this, right? In New York and other states that have what's called a closed shop, the union has the duty to represent everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a member or not. If you're part of the bargaining unit, we have to provide grievance services and all the work that we all do to win a contract. The contract applies to every single person in the bargaining unit, whether they're members or not. So for those services, grievances and the bargaining, if you're not a member and you can, that's a choice, you pay a fee and then you're called a fee payer. In other states that don't have this system, that are open shops, you don't have to join the union and you don't have to be a fee payer, but you still get all the collective bargaining results and you still have the grievance procedures. The argument in this Supreme Court case is very simple. It says that, well, I'll say one more thing, which is that if we make political contributions, and if you want to, here's the Vote COPE, the union has a political fund, that's entirely separate. The money that's spent for labor management talks, grievance counselors, and research about bargaining is what comes out of dues and fees. Anything for lobbying, state, local, doesn't matter, federal, that's all out of separate contributions that union members voluntarily, or fee payers voluntarily make. Here's the catch. According to this legal theory, which was a 4-4 split in the Supreme Court, if you are a member of a public employee union, anytime you give up something, healthcare, salary, whatever, taxes could go down. Anytime you gain something, an office hour for adjuncts, taxes go up. So it's all so inherently political that union membership is a violation of the First Amendment if you're a public employee if you're a public employee union. So this has been in the past rejected by the Supreme Court in the 1970s in a Boot case, but it is a theory that that got a 4-4 vote after the death of one justice who's been replaced by someone who is certain to give it a 5-4 vote. What that will mean is that the day that that vote takes place and the decision comes down, the union will lose the fees from anyone who is not a member. So that, just in our small union, could be $1 million less to the union. And in the state, the New York State United Teachers is our parent union. And I think that that union could be really affected as well. And that would really have an impact on how we have a presence. The flip side possibility is that if we decide we're going to double down and stand together, we could switch from being fee payers to making sure that we're union members. And if you would like to do that, I have union membership cards right here. I'm happy to take them and hand them in tonight. And I'm also looking for people to go around and make departments aware of this. So it's a really simple proposition. The union will either be weaker as a result of this decision in the spring, or if we act now, if we take a look and see what's our status, what's my colleague's status, can I sign up again, we can be stronger. And this card does something else. It says that even if you resign your union membership, you'll keep paying dues for the remainder of that year. And it gives you a 10-day window each year when you could stop paying dues and quit. And there's a simple reason for that. It's because as soon as this decision comes down, the Koch brothers have funded a lot of other groups, and there have been local cases like this, and they will have people knocking on your door, and they'll send you pamphlets, and there'll be a website to opt out, and it will say, only you can decide if union membership is right or wrong for you, but don't you need $500? Wouldn't you like a Christmas vacation? Wouldn't you like a computer? Don't you need a raise? It might be the last one you get, but they won't say that. So that's what I got, and if you have any questions or comments, I'm happy to take it to the Delegate Assembly. Yeah?
You said that the union has presented the Board of Trustees and the request to begin negotiating. Why have you heard from the Board of Trustees?
I don't know. Glenda, do you know why we haven't heard from the Board of Trustees? Right. Neither do I. I don't know. We have not heard back from the Board of at least the last I checked. Certainly as of Monday night when the rally was held, we had not heard from the Board of Trustees. You know, what relationship Bill Thompson has with what he thinks he's going to get from Bill from Cuomo and all of that, I don't know. Yes?
I'm curious as a student because I don't
really know. Sure. Right, so one thing I'll say is they have a good website, the central office types. I can tell you that as a general rule, the PSC over the last couple of years has fought hard against tuition increases, that there's a very strong position that tuition cannot fund this university. It hasn't funded this university. It really hasn't. If you don't, and do you know about the TAP gap? Okay, so a brief piece on the TAP gap. Briefer even than the analysis of the 80 the alumni. So if you get full TAP, that's roughly $5,000. That TAP used to be, full TAP used to be the equivalent of full tuition, but the tuition has gone up. However, historically, because when universities expanded during the Depression and after World War II in other states, they did not here. TAP goes to any New York student who's attending a private university as well, who has need. So it's very expensive to raise TAP, and no one has broken the tie between TAP and all universities. Or done something specific for public universities. But what the governor has said is, I'm going to budget that each student will pay $6,500 tuition, let's say. But if you have a student who has TAP, and TAP is $5,000, that's all you can collect. So there's a $1,500 deficit in the way the governor has calculated the budget per fully funded TAP student. And what that means is that the university has to struggle to make ends meet with less income than the governor has budgeted that it should have, even in his meager budget. That's unconscionable, right? What we think is that there needs to be a different kind of tax basis. So that's one thing you can say to students. But I can also tell you that when there was a $485 million cut proposed for the CUNY budget, the chancellor who's stepping down, and this may have something to do with the negotiations also, was asked point blank at a hearing, is that a cut? And he said, I've been assured the money will be made up from other places. Because he's the chancellor and that's what he said. And the Board of Trustees didn't scream about it either in public. The union said, that's cut.
Do you think there are any very vehement counter arguments
I have not heard of particular criticisms about union activism. I think that there are particular demands that the union makes that the administration might disagree with, but I don't think in general that the university has argued that there should not be a union or that the union is acting in bad faith about anything. I can tell you one thing that's also of deep interest to people at Queens, which is how much time we get to spend working with students and doing research, and how much we have to spend with the workload of courses or other kinds of responsibilities. There's a CUNY-wide effort in the contract to reduce the course load by one course per full-time faculty member, and there's an argument about where Queens falls in that, because Queens has a 3-3 load that they assign, as opposed to a seven courses a year, there might be an argument about how to fund it and whether Queens is already at that load reduction or not. That's a kind of arcane technical argument that the union and the university have. But the university has never said, we don't believe in grievances, we don't believe that employees should have protection. That hasn't been an issue. So I don't know what you might have in mind. And I think in general, for people's time and their sake, I'm happy to talk to you afterwards or something like that.
Let me remind everyone that the sessions are recorded, so when you don't come to the mic, we don't hear what the questions are, we only hear the response. Manuel Sanudo Library, okay. David, is there anything going to happen because the chancellor is resigning, either positive or negative, in the contract negotiations?
So the contract negotiations, I have to say, haven't started yet. So the negative possibility is that they won't really start until there's a new chancellor. Another concern, though the union would say there's a lot of non-economic demands that could get bargained on all the time while you wait for an economic package. That's another possibility. I think the other concern would be that there are some CUNY campuses that have had searches that were not public until you bring in like one final candidate to ask questions. And there would be a big concern and argument if that happened with the chancellor, if there was not a full public search with more than one finalist being publicly interviewed.
Betsy Hendry, Provost. And this is not actually a question so much as just a comment on the discussion about the reducing workload in order for faculty to be able to spend more time with students in research. It is our understanding, the president has asked, it is our understanding that the reduction would be taking into account current practices, but that it's simply a question of finding the funds, because obviously that reduction will be expensive. But that is our understanding.
That is great. I have heard that there were talks underway going in that direction, and you may be more current than me. I think what that shows, though, is that the union and administrations on campuses are not completely in the dark about each other's efforts, and that the university in general understands the roles that unions can play, and that we've managed to achieve a few things with that separate understanding. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Reichel from Political Science. I just wanted to reiterate, I think the point that one of the students was making, which the demands sound pretty ambitious, 5% a year and 7 doubling basically the pay for adjuncts. And I would just be concerned that those not be things that would be funded by tuition increases, because that effectively becomes a transfer of money from students to us. And so I don't know if there's a way in which either formally as part of the bargaining process, negotiations over various salary and benefits can be linked to negotiations over broader issues of funding and tuition, or whether more informally union efforts to promote the contract can also be linked to efforts to work on behalf of larger funding issues for the university and issues of tuition. So in either of those regards, is there a way to ensure that our raises are not a transfer of wealth from students to us?
So Alex, you are the expert about New York State politics, and we have had you speak to us. So, you know, what I want to say is this, right? There's this, right now there's a memorandum, a maintenance of effort that the governor hasn't vetoed yet, that the Senate and Assembly both passed by really large numbers. And what that says is, I can't remember what's the baseline on it. Is it 2008? But whatever, that at some point, you know, the rational, they're called rational tuition increases as opposed to who we don't want to see what's really crazy, right? But if we go up 150 a year, right, it's predictable. That doesn't make it rational. Anyway, the maintenance of effort would say that the tuition increases cannot be used to fund basic things like salaries, like lighting. Like if the governor does something which I support and says, let's close the nuclear power plant at Indian Point, it's too close to the city, it's aged out, it's a bad idea, okay. But if the way he's doing it is by making consumers pay higher electricity bills and the college's electricity bill goes up, right now the maintenance of effort bill is our best effort to say the Senate, the governor has to create a budget that takes those cost increases into account. It cannot, so there's a petition for that. You could contact Cuomo's office and push on that. He vetoed it 2 years ago. The likelihood may be that he vetoes it again, but we would like that to cost him something. What I can say is that until there's a provision like that, the union can say we don't want tuition increases, and we can ally with community groups through CUNY Rising, and we can, but ultimately, you can't stop a tuition increase from being part of a package unless you have enough political power to do that. The only other thing I'd say is that even the tuition increases because of things like the TAP gap and the rest of it, they gouge students. They don't fund the university adequately. What we've talked about is it means increasing taxes, and Cuomo has not wanted to do that. But you know this better than I. Thank you very much.
Tonight at the meeting. Has everyone signed in? Any alternates that have come in, please come sign in now. Okay? Next item on the agenda, there are no special motions. Item number 5A, Undergraduate Curriculum Committee.
I'd like to move the minutes of the November 9th Undergraduate Curriculum Committee meeting and ask for unanimous consent.
Any objection to unanimous consent?
I have.
Okay.
First of all, dealing with psychology, where they are requiring that henceforth students may only repeat Psych 107 and Psych 213W one time. This seems to me rather punitive. It seems to run against the policy of wanting increased retention, and I'm opposed to it for those reasons, and I would hope that what I consider to be punitive measure does not go through. I have another objection of a smaller type pertaining to economics, where in their requirements they state that the prerequisite for a math course, math 231, this is on page 5, three lines down from the top. The prerequisites for math 231 are math 141 and math 142. Well, the math department sets the prerequisites for math courses, and the prerequisite we have in the math department for math 231, also known as linear algebra, is merely one semester of calculus. So I don't believe it is proper for another department to establish different prerequisites for a course, for one of our courses, different prerequisites than the prerequisite that we have. I think that's improper.
That's just a typo. We'll fix that.
Excuse me?
That's just a typo. We'll fix that.
I don't think it's a typo. Because it existed before, I didn't notice it before. It appears in the from part and also in the to read part. At any rate, I would hope that that would be corrected to what it truly is, namely the prerequisite for math 231 is just one semester of calculus.
Alan Ludman, College at Large. There are two ways for students to satisfy the requirement of a year of calculus. One of them is by taking calculus math 151 and 152. The other is by taking calculus 141, 142, and 143. The purpose there, is my understanding, is that students who are not confident in their ability can spend three semesters covering exactly the same material as in the two-semester 151, 152 sequence, which leads me to believe that what's covered in math 141 and half of 142 would be comparable to a semester of calculus.
I think what we need to do is simply look it up in the bulletin of what the official prerequisite is for this course and fix it.
Okay. Ron, okay. I'd like to just speak to what Alan said. What he said is correct. However, our interpretation in the math department about the prerequisite for math 231, linear algebra, which is an extremely popular course, given that computer science majors who are Bachelor of Science majors, not Bachelor of Arts, Bachelor of Science majors in computer science are required to take math 231. And we have many such students, so we give around, I think, six or seven sections this semester in 231. But anyway, we interpret the one semester of calculus as being satisfied by 141. Okay, and that's a fact. Now, maybe it shouldn't be, but that's what we accept.
Okay, well, then we'll take that as an editorial change, yeah. And that part will be taken care of. Anyone now discussing the part? Let's go back to the psychology department.
Emily Jones, the psychology department. This was a decision that we talked about for a very long time about how to ensure that the students who are coming through our required course sequence make it through successfully, and so the change in the number of times that students can retake the class was one of the changes that we made to increase the likelihood that students will get out on time and get through the more advanced experimental design courses that they need to take.
The professor of psychology just said that she'd like to have students get out on time. It's a very noble desire. However, if you have a requirement that a student is not allowed to take a course, to repeat a course more than once, if that student just drops out of the course once, then it seems to me if he drops it again or fails it again, he's out. He won't be, that student will not be retained by the college. He will be eliminated according to this, the way I read this new proposal.
Alan Ludman again. There's a big difference between dropping a course and failing it. And we're not talking about dropping a course, we're talking about failing it. And there are other departments on campus that have limits to the number of times a student may repeat a course. This is the psych department's limit. We had a student take mineralogy 5 times. We changed that rule pretty quickly. That person repeating the course again and again and again is occupying a seat that other students can't take, and we don't think it's fair to the other students either. So this is in keeping with other practices at the college.
Okay, no amendment has been forwarded, so what's on the floor right now is the report with the editorial change that was done for the economics part. So this is what's on the floor. All in favor of the motion with the editorial change in economics, please raise your voting card. Okay. Opposed. One. Abstentions. Two. Wait a minute. Opposed. Raise your voting cards. Four. And abstentions. Okay. The motion carries. Okay. Next item on the agenda is the Graduate Curriculum Committee report.
On behalf of the Graduate Curriculum Committee, I present the minutes of the meeting of November 1st, 2017, and ask for unanimous consent.
Any objections to unanimous consent? Okay, seeing none, motion carries.
Thank you.
Next item, 5C, is the Elections Committee report.
Hi, Simone Yearwood, Library Chair, Election Committee. The proposal is as follows. Student and faculty nominations to begin at 12:01 a.m. on Sunday, February 18th, 2018, and end at 11:59 p.m. Saturday, March 3rd. Date of record, February 23rd, 2018. Student elections to begin 12:01 a.m. Sunday, April 15th, 2018, through 11:59 p.m. Thursday, April 19th, 2018. Faculty elections to begin 12:01 a.m. Sunday, April 15th, through 11:59 p.m. Saturday, April 21st, 2018. I request a motion to accept.
Okay, before, let me mention for everyone, the date of record, February 23rd, 2018, is the date by which everyone has to have submitted, for instance, incompletes or whatever, and that is the date then that someone is judged to be, for instance, a sophomore, whatever it is. Okay, so that's that date of record. Any objections? Come to the mic, discussion.
Hi, good evening. I would like to amend for the student elections to be held for 3 days instead of 5 days. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because a lot of students feel inconvenience for the 5 days. We don't want to bother them. And from Sunday to Tuesday, we will be able to speak to many students, like the Sunday students who go to school in the morning and also in the evening, from Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. So that way, students know what we have to say, students are able to vote, and students don't feel inconvenienced or bothered for the rest of the week. Thank you.
As previously stated, Queens College is a 7-day-a-week institution. Students should have the ability to vote while on campus, and inconveniencing other students, they need to police themselves and behave in an adult fashion. So that bothering, I think faculty will have to control their classes, and students will have to police themselves on how they campaign. So my reasoning behind 5 days a week is to give students the ability to vote while on campus.
Okay, there has been no amendment, so the motion as proposed still stands.
Karandeep Singh, SA. I would basically want to say about the 3-day election is that at the end of the day, it is 24 hours. The link is active for the full 24 hours. And if we have for 3 days, 24 hours each, 72 hours. But now, in addition to that, what it also does, especially for the faculty, you won't have students coming about the elections, hey, can I write on your board? Because it takes up a lot of the classroom time as well. Because all the students come to learn at Queens College. You don't want people coming for the whole 2 other days, where in the past, those other 2 days as well didn't count as many votes compared to Sunday to Tuesday. So those are just extra days adding on where the students have to face people coming to them, hey, can you guys vote for me? Can you vote for me? And then also the faculty members saying, oh, so there's a student that's coming to my class, he wants to write this, give a little speech, and they're on.
Further debate?
Yes, for the 3-day proposal, they said all students would not be covered during the 3 days, but weekend students will be covered, and then there's Monday, Tuesday classes, which are Monday, Wednesday scheduled, and then Tuesday, Thursday as well. So almost weekend students and Monday, Tuesday students will be covered. And students who also do come in the Wednesday and Thursday do also come in on the Monday, Tuesday as well. So all students will be covered.
Okay. Just to note, we have graduate students who are sometimes only on campus 1 day a week, and that 1 day could be Thursday or Wednesday. So a Sunday through Tuesday will eliminate 2 days for a graduate student for the ability to vote while on campus.
In proposal to the 3-day elections, most of the elections are done online on a link that is 24/7. These elections are blasted throughout social media and through the internet. Anybody that has a link that has been achieved through many ways through social media or Facebook or even on the Queens College website have access to sign in with their credentials and to vote.
It would seem to me then that we just need a no electioneering campaign in which you're not allowed to accost anyone on campus since it's all available online. Then the problem of students being overwhelmed by people attacking them saying, vote, 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 here's my computer, please vote, that would go away if you're not allowed to do it. As far as my being inconvenienced, I don't allow anyone to walk into my classroom and start an electioneer. If I were to do so, I would have to give the same right to every candidate for the same party. What you're doing is you're preventing people from voting. This is what we're trying to fight in this country. Why are we allowing it on campus? I think the 3 days are a mistake. I agree with everything I've just heard. In my department, graduate courses, because our students come in the evening, are 1 day a week. Some of them are Thursday evening. And you're saying the weekend students will be there. Saturday is also part of the weekend. That's not built into this in any way. So a student who comes only on Saturday because they're a part-timer can't vote, unless they remember to do it online. So I would be more than happy to see someone say, no electioneering is allowed. You're not allowed to accost anyone on campus. I suspect no one wants to do that. So I think we leave it as it is. If it's the best we can get, instead of a 7-day, I'll live with this. 3 days, I think, is far too short.
Victor, you're at the mic.
I really appreciate hearing faculty, you know, testimonies on this issue. I think that in the past election, a main issue was like a lot of students didn't vote at all. They sort of didn't have information on, you know, what the parties were. And even if they did, many students complained that they sort of got pressured into taking the first, you know, party that approached them in a seemingly coercive way. So I'm supportive of reforms in general. I know you mentioned that it might be difficult to implement reforms, but I think that it would be better for the health of the school's sort of politics and the school's governance if there were election reforms that made it possible so that students made more informed decisions in electing their school officials.
I would just like to add on to the question where there was some issues with saying that only students come at a certain time, like let's say they only come Wednesdays because they have their full-time workers but are part-time students. But at the end of the day, you gotta realize they are a Queens College student, and every Queens College student has a Q-mail that they are given by the college, and from there, every student is sent out an email saying, hey, look, elections are coming up, this is a link, these are the instructions, and you guys are more than welcome to vote. And in addition to that, like we were talking about before, it is also shown on social media that people are spreading it. Elections are going on. So that's why the three-day period still could work and still target those that only come to school for one day.
With regards to Victor's suggestion, I will speak to the Dean of Student Services to request an introduction of the candidates to try to have a formative election so they can get to know the parties. So that's the only thing I have with regards to that. And again, I would love nothing more than a 7-day. I try to compromise with a 5-day. And I really do think, as a faculty member with no allegiance one way or another, that 3 days is just entirely too short. And people typically do not remember the voting season is open until they're on campus. And to think that students really read their emails is kind of, I don't mean to, but students do not read their emails. And so to rely strictly on that, it's not a possibility. We started by putting up banners that students see when they come to campus.
I think we're arguing something that shouldn't be argued because we don't have an amendment to vote on. And I would ask one of the people who wishes to move this to a 3-day to formally move an amendment so that we can actually, well, we've debated it already, we can actually vote on it.
I'm sorry, that was my mistake. Motion to amend.
You want to make a motion to?
So the motion to amend was changing it from a 5-day election period to a 3-day election period from Sunday to Tuesday. I apologize for the inconvenience.
Okay, so then for the student elections, you want to amend from Sunday the 15th until Monday, Tuesday the 17th. And the times, I assume, would remain the same, 12:01 a.m. to begin with on Sunday, and end Tuesday night at 11:59 p.m.
Would you take out Thursday and put it?
Yes. And that's only for the students, then.
Is there a second
to that motion? Second. Okay. Debate on this motion, on the amendment.
Japney Singh, student body president here at Queens College. Speaking as a grad student here at Queens College and a person that does have Friday and Saturday classes, I totally agree with what you're saying. If we're making a big discussion about when the election dates are, why not make it Friday and Saturday? In my recent memory, I've been in 5 years. It was never Friday or Saturday. So I never understood that because the whole point of making it Sunday is to get weekend students, but that's never happened. And going back to the point, just to give you guys some financial numbers, we spend about $4,000 to get this site up. $4,000. If we use those resources and put bulletin boards and other resources around campus to get students, a lot of master's students are in Powder Maker, are in Kylie, are in Science Building. Why can't we put flyers and brochures up there and get them when they're, as they're exiting, entering? 24 hours, 7 days a week, it goes to your email. I know a lot of master's students that are in my class, they do check their emails. Master's students, if you're talking about master's students. Because again, they have jobs, they have to do other things, and they do require the email. But we're spending $4,000 on a site, again, we don't even capture all the student population. So doing a 3-day election, the cost goes down, and that money could go to other resources that, can help promote people to vote.
Raya Ali. I'm a freshman sophomore representative. Also, I would like to add to, I agree with the 3-day election. My reason for that is if we do the suggestion that was suggested that we can have a campaign that each group would say what their campaign is, what they're trying to achieve, and both parties would try to advocate for themselves, and that way we can even publish it to the school, and whoever is interested would come to attend that event where people can listen to each party's accomplishments or goals. That way we can reach out as many people who are even interested, because a lot of the students that we approach during election weeks aren't even interested in an election. They don't want to vote, and that's their right. So by doing that suggestion, we can grab everyone who's actually interested. They would have the chance to hear from both parties, and that way they can vote whenever they can for those three days. Also, what we're saying is by the end of the 5 days, like at the fourth and the fifth day, students, it's usually during like exams and finals, and students are really tired of elections, and those who voted or those who didn't vote and don't want to vote are just bothered with the idea of having to like be approached, or not even approached, like if seeing the flyers and everything going on again when all they want to focus on is on their tests. Especially us people who actually want to get votes, we are also students and we have our exams, and I feel like 5 days is just too long for a simple election that can also, with the suggestion, would be so much easier and everyone would have access to the information needed during that time. Thanks.
Further debate on the amendment?
I will, as chair, I will look into Alan's suggestion on about the possibility of removing campaigning from campus completely, and then I move that we put a vote for the new amendment for the 3 days.
Further debate?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please? I didn't.
One of the suggestions was made that we try to restrict campaigning totally on campus. I'll look into the possibilities of that, and you guys will have to figure out. It seems as if the biggest contention is students feel bothered about people approaching them to vote. You have some students who are a bit more timid than others. I was a weekend student. I thought about school when I was at school. So that's why I advocated for a longer period of voting, because I was a Queens College student. I was here during the in-house voting machine days. So what's happening today is nothing compared to what happened. I won't give away how long ago I went to class, but it's nothing compared to how it was. And we got through it. So this is going to be an ongoing fight. So that's all I'm saying, basically.
Point of personal service, I'm not arguing against campaigning. I'm arguing against harassment.
Right, that's the key.
You can campaign. There should be areas where campaigning is allowed. Matters can be posted. I personally have torn them down in areas where they have not been allowed, and I will continue to do so. I think campaigning is part of the American system. I think it's part of our system, and I think it should be done. What I object to, and what I'm hearing you're objecting to, is the fact that you are harassing students.
Right.
They're voting because they're being harassed, and you're saying, well, to make that easier, let us only harass them for 3 days.
One thing I just want to add on to the part where they were mentioned that not everyone looks at their emails. I was a club leader. I still currently am a club leader in the school. So I personally check my email maybe every 5 hours, to be honest, just to see if there's any updates going on. And also in addition to that, when you guys were talking about how it gives a fair representation, you know, having all the parties represent themselves, why not just put all the parties in the email so that way it's easier for everyone to see what party is trying to do what, so that way everyone has a clear representation, because it's the responsibility of the student to check their email on a daily, not the responsibility of the party or whoever. That's their right. They have that email for a reason, and they're supposed to be using it.
Okay, any further debate on this, on the amendment? Let me remind you, for the amendment to pass, we need 31 votes. So what I'm going to ask now is, you're voting on the amendment. Yes, that means we change it to 3 days. All in favor of changing the amendment to 3 days, raise your voting cards. Okay. All opposed. So the amendment fails. We're back to the original motion. Any more debate on the original motion? All right, if none, now we're voting on the original motion, which is up here. And it's in your packets. Everyone in favor of the original motion that's up behind me, raise your voting cards. This also takes 31. All against. 5 and abstentions. So the motion carries. Election periods, nomination periods are what we see up on the board. Okay, next item, 5D, nominating committee.
Sarah Wolf, on behalf of Marion Fish, the nominating committee asks for your unanimous approval of the slate of nominees in your packet.
Okay, any objection to unanimous consent on the nominating committee report? Okay, seeing none, motion carries. There is no old business. And is there any new business? Any new business? Okay, all in favor? Opposed? None? Okay, motion carries. Have a good holiday. Our next meeting isn't until February. I didn't think...